Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today we are speaking to the founder and CEO of Sprinklr, which is the premium enterprise software company, generally known to be a category leader in social media management space for, you know, like 1,500 of the world's largest brands. And it's a really great conversation with Raji Thomas that I had at Collision a few weeks ago. And actually, I want to quickly throw out there, I've been speaking a lot between Collision in New Orleans and Madrid in Poland, which I just finished up last week. So we're going to have a more regular schedule going forward. But I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation with Raji. So let's jump into the conversation.
Yeah.
So I am here at Collision, and I'm speaking to Raji Thomas, the head of Sprinklr. Which, if you don't know, if you've been living underneath a rock for a while now, you wouldn't know that it's pretty much the leading enterprise social media software out there. But how would you describe Sprinklr in general?
We are a premium enterprise software company, generally known to be a category leader in the social media management space for large businesses. And what that means is about 1,500 of the world's largest brands use Sprinklr to do marketing, advertising, research, commerce, and customer care on a single unified platform across 24 social media channels on Sprinklr.
You guys have done, I feel like, so many different, and it's been very cool. It's always nice for me to see kind of a platform that I've recommended to people and then see more and more people jump on it, and then here, presumably, you get consumer feedback, customer feedback, and then you keep iterating off of the product and figuring out what are the most important things to add as, you know, feature technology. So that's why I really wanted to talk to you, because how do you, this is like one bigger question that I always think about, how do you get better at predicting the future on an ongoing basis with respect to, you know, your platform, because you have to figure out how people are going to be using social media, how companies are, what features they're going to need. So how do you go about trying to predict the future and paying attention to the market?
So we are a thesis-driven company, and so which means that our North Star and where we are going is very clearly defined. It was defined when I founded the company, and it was just not obvious to the world because we're a multi-stage reveal. In fact, we're not a social media management company, and that's what others call us, and you have to live in the box for that period so that people can understand who you are without you having to explain every time. What we're creating is the world's first customer experience management platform that allows you to go across channels externally and across silos internally so that a big brand can reach, engage, and listen to people on the other side across their functions. We think that's a very powerful idea. We think it has the potential to be the single most strategic enterprise software that most of these brands will ever have, a unified view of that customer. So that's our true north, and that has never wavered. How we get it right, it's like when you punch in your address into Google Maps, then it'll take you around if there's traffic blocks or whatever. So how we get it right on a day-to-day release-by-release basis is by using our customers as our navigation device. So our product roadmap tactically gets prioritized 100% by what customers vote for with their dollars. I don't go by how excited people get. That's misleading. So we go by what more customers are willing to pay for, and there's a very democratic process. We've kind of perfected at Sprinklr where we have defining partners, we have limited availability and general availability, and, you know, some of the world's most digital savvy customers and most, like in top 10, most of the leaders in most industries are Sprinklr customers. So we benefit from their wisdom and their expertise in guiding us through to our mission.
You know, so I think also one thing that's interesting is you're talking in some ways about the wisdom of the crowd, and what if people are talking about they want something, you're actually being very attentive to them. I kind of liken it in some ways to walking through the different startups, early stage startups here, and how I was here last year, I saw a lot more chatbot technologies mm-hmm. last year versus mm-hmm. this year. And to mm-hmm. me, what that says is most likely that is something that, for whatever reason, a lot of companies didn't get the positive market feedback that they wanted. And as a result, now you're going to have more startups investing in a different way. So,
yeah.
I mean, how do you even kind of get, obviously, besides going to conferences like this, getting the ideas about what will help the product achieve that true north?
It comes from the clarity of vision. So we know exactly the problem we're looking to solve. So when you observe customers, you see the latent pain points. They're very, very obvious to us. And I have a slightly different take on the chatbot and the other sort of point solution markets.
Yes, please.
You know, chatbots are wonderful. I don't think that's a category or should ever be a category. It's really something that should be inside of an operational platform like Sprinklr. It's like AI. I mean, I think AI should be in every piece of technology that's going to get built. But trying to think of it, I'm going to create an AI company. As these categories get identified, everybody with and their brother with an idea jumps in, and there are geniuses who fund it, and then they get exposed as a point solution. And I don't think, at least in the enterprise space, people want more point solutions. We're done having a million point solutions.
This is actually, it's funny because what you're talking about, I think I've had this exact same conversation with people where they say, okay, we need like a 360 strategy for this launch. We need email marketing. What are we going to do? Facebook, what are we going to do? Advertising, what are we going to do? Artificial intelligence, what are... And I'm like, wait, that thing... That will be baked into all these other channels and platforms. It's not its own thing. It's something that permeates everywhere else.
Yeah, you said it better than I did.
Yeah, no, I don't know about that. But I'll take the compliment from a smart enough guy. But so how about in terms of going like five steps back, okay? Like how did you get to, I know some of the story, but how you identified the market opportunity and saw that this was something that customer experience was going to be critical. But how did you get from kind of like, tell us, like, walk us through your career until the founding of Sprinklr and to where you guys are now today with a ton of enterprise clientele?
Yeah, 1,500.
15, yeah, which is a lot when they're, you know, cutting checks that end with a few zeros. So, yeah.
We're not complaining. God is kind. So I'm a product person. My undergrad is in computer science and started out programming and... You know, architecture, design, product management, ownership, CTO, CEO. So I've taken the product path. I'm a product first CEO, if you will. My company is customer first, so don't confuse that. My background is product. Now there are sales led CEOs and operations led CEOs. I'm a product led guy. So that's my background. And along the way, I did. An MBA as well. So, I mean, you just pick up these sort of theoretical knowledge in bits and pieces. But, you know, nothing replaces the journey that you go through and you learn through multiple startups, and that's where the scars and the...
Yeah, I was just going to say what's very interesting to me is that you have a strong product, but also the messaging around the perception of the product is also strong. And this is my experience. I think I've spoken to a lot of product marketers, marketing managers who then come up through the ranks and found companies, and they care a lot about, is my product better, and not as much about the perception of the product being better. And I think that what you guys have done artfully is to kind of balance those two. I mean, so how important is it for you, kind of wearing both hats, to make sure that the product is strong, but also that the perception of it is strong? Because often you see VHS versus Betamax, right? Not always the more technically superior product wins out in the marketplace.
We are, I've said before that we are unapologetically the most ambitious company that came out of the social space. That means we have a tremendous number of features and capabilities inside a platform. We got 43 modules right now. So as we added products and added capabilities, the story became very confusing. And when you're as ambitious as we are, you can't bring that to life and to market and to value, to deliver value for customers if you don't simplify it for them to consume it. So that was behind the sort of the undertaking we did last year, where we simplified everything into 19 products based on industries or sub-industries in digital and social. We organized them into 6 clouds. So you can buy a social cloud, marketing cloud, advertising cloud, research cloud, commerce cloud, and care cloud. We clarified how we don't replace or compete with companies like Salesforce or IBM, but partner with them. We're complementary because we don't do email. That's what their marketing cloud does. And then we went to market with the whole thing as one unified cloud, which is our customer experience cloud. So you can choose to have all these different buying units by their clouds. But in fact, the enterprise is knowingly or unknowingly creating their first ever CXM implementation.
And one thing that I really like that you focus on customer experience, because the technology, I feel like to focus on customer experience is inherently human, versus if you're trying to solve for one particular technology, you lose sight that, well, VR is only good provided it's solving like an innate human need, which is, I think, really smart. I mean, what do you think, especially as you're paying attention to the next few years, that the customer experience, what will the customer expect more a few years from now that they don't necessarily expect right now?
If you haven't realized it already, you have to understand the binary shift that has happened from the brand being in control to the customer being in control. And it's a one-way street. So customers expect zero friction at every touch point. Customers expect value delivered across the life cycle. And every part of that buying journey has changed. And if you look at marketing, they're relying on each other, not the brand, for how good the product is to find out. In advertising, they're expecting advertising to be personalized. So you can't go with A-B testing. You really have to think about A, B, C, and like a million variations based on what the customer cares about. Your feedback has to come into the organization in real time. You can't run a focus group. God, you can't even run a survey. Like, nobody wants a survey. I got news. We don't wake up going like, I wish I got another survey.
I want to meet that person. Yeah.
And then, you know, in commerce, these conversations, these reviews, they drive commerce. It's not like a capability. They drive it. Yeah. In care, we believe that care is a new marketing, because that's what people engage in. If you piss people off, they're going to tell each other. And because what others say matter more than what you say, you can't market. So this altered reality is what every brand has to be ready for. So you project it out and say, what would the customer want? These are the 5 things that we think customers are going to want more and more. Personalized service at every touch point that's frictionless creates value for them.
And, you know, speaking of frictionless, I think also one thing that's very interesting right now, I feel like, is people are becoming a little bit more aware of online privacy and how their data is being used, right? I mean, yep. This is very hot right now. So to me, what's interesting is people are expecting personalization, but then also when you see something personalized, it's like you want it to not be creepy. And I'm wondering, do you think that there's even an inherent tension in that? Because I think that people, my personal opinion is that nobody cares really about privacy as long as they're having value being delivered. If it's something that's adding a little bit to your life, a product that is relevant to you at this moment in time, nobody's like, how dare they send me something relevant? But I think that there's obviously a little bit of backlash, you know, post-Cambridge Analytica news and whatnot. So what do you think there on there?
Jeremy, I think it's ignorance, my friend. I think it's a lot of people not knowing how this stuff works. If you think about direct mail, you know, all the postal mail that you get in your house, and we've been getting lots of 15, 20 years, Nobody knows how the data is collected. I do because I was on the other side. And, I was a part of a large direct marketing company when we sold a business. That data comes from subscriptions, from postal services, from retail records, and all kinds of stuff that people don't think is being shared. And random third-party surveys and stuff like that. And there is nowhere you can go and say, well, take me out of all those databases, because they're completely distributed and disseminated, and there's no centralized ownership. That is way more concerning than what's going on in social. In social, most of our core partners, like Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, makes it very easy for you to understand who you're saying this to. Makes it very easy for you to go and see, like Google does as well, another partner of ours, makes it very easy for you to see all the data they have on you. Makes it very easy for you to go and delete it. So here are the newer channels that make it easy to control who you say what to, gives you a perpetual right to go and delete it and control and tweak it, and you're worried about privacy there?
Yeah.
Now, you're a bad actor. You should be worried. If you want to have anonymous access to online, that should be a problem. Now, this is a concept that I'm going to go public with, and this is the first time I'm talking publicly about it. I'm a big advocate of a concept that I call verified web. We should move to the verified web, meaning right now, like if you go look at my Twitter account or Facebook account, you know, you see a blue check mark, which means I'm verified. Now, they do that for a very limited subset of people. So I was at Facebook.
But they gave it to me. What the heck?
No, you're special.
I know.
But my point is, right now, let's say it's given to 0.01% of their audience. And I was at Facebook yesterday, and my suggestion was, guys, like, move to 99% of the audience being verified.
Yeah.
And so if you're a bad actor who wants to say stuff without taking responsibility for saying it, and you want to remain unverified, you're the exception. There are all the shady things that people do, like that nobody who's revealing their identity would want to do. So I think the notion of moving to the verified web will finally unlock the full power of social to change the world for good.
Yeah, I think that would be huge, would be very interesting, even if you could go back in time and implement that at, you know, previous elections, let's say. But I think in all seriousness, when you think about that, it also kind of strikes me at a conversation I had at Collision last year with Ticketmaster, with their verified fan program, mm-hmm. if you're familiar at all.
No.
They essentially had this idea, but on a much more micro scale, just talking about fans, because you want to make sure that actual fans get tickets to shows versus, and I can't help but think that, sure, wouldn't the world be a better place if you had everybody standing behind what they're saying, mm-hmm. and not having people do, like, for instance, a misleading person who I knew in a Facebook group said, hey, I walked past this particular children's playroom. It looks like it's really interesting. I feel like I'm going to go check it out. And people researched this person and found out this was the person who was opening the store themselves. So the transparency is, I think, going back to the point that you said, if you're scared of people finding something out, well, that means there's something to find out. Like, what are you so afraid of?
You're right. You have to disclose. We call it the three-step, and Sprinklr will be launching a privacy module cloud. The three steps are disclosure, like how did you get the data, what are you doing with it, who are you? Number two, express consent. Did the person expressly opt in to interact or be connected to? And third, the full control of staying opted in. You know, and if you give the person control to opt out, that's fair game. And if they understand value, that's a choice that people make. We played this entire thing out in email. That's where I got the clarity from. There was spam, and we did three things, right? We did anti-spam technology got better. Bill Gates and others did a phenomenal job with developing the technology, Hotmail, AOL. Number two, the good guys had IP whitelisting. So if you're getting an email from the bank, like what I would send would go through a different trusted highway, if you will. It's like the TSA pre-check
or
the clear.
Yeah.
And then the third is some form of regulation that allows bad actors to be put away when they're caught. So that's how this is going to get solved. And I think there's a lot of panic over nothing. And I think it's people kind of not being very informed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's true. And I think that also, likewise, one thing that a lot of people are talking about is GDPR and the fact that that is dawning soon. And I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about what GDPR actually is and whether or not U.S. companies will follow suit. Just forget about whether or not they should or not, but is it even in their best interest? I mean, if you're doing business in the EU, there are certain things that you're going to have to be doing as a business, you know, especially if you're holding on to consumer data. And I mean, do you see the companies stateside making the right moves in terms of transparency, and or do you think that there's anything that, on the whole, from a regulation standpoint, has to occur?
I think innovative companies that put customers first should embrace it wholeheartedly. I think it's a one-way street, and it's a question of when, not if. And trust is paramount in a world where customers are in control. And the more you can do to get ahead of it, the better you are.
Mm-hmm. Is there any major particular, could be a platform, and obviously this is a little bit different because you work with, I know, all these different platforms, so it's not like you can make a particular prediction about so-and-so is going to grow by 12% and so-and-so will decline, but are there any particular even trends within these different social media marketing platforms that you're paying close attention to or that you predict will change over the next few years, such as video becoming more commonplace or, you know, short form format getting bigger, anything like that?
I was at F8 yesterday, and, you know, Facebook is making the world a lot more connected. They have a very clear mission, and they're moving very fast. Twitter seemed to have found its sort of place in the world.
Mm-hmm.
LinkedIn's found their place in the world. So I think what we're getting clarity around clusters of context. So most people are clear on when to use Facebook versus when to use LinkedIn versus when to use Twitter. And most people understand that you go talk to your family and friends on Facebook, your business colleagues on LinkedIn, and to everyone on Twitter. And I think those are secular trends that we see. And I think within those, there's secular movement towards richer content, you know, videos, one-way street, 3D, AR. So that's just a technology evolution that I think most big players will continue to chase. AI-based, you know, removal of friction, making things better.
It's funny because when you were talking before about removal of friction points, I think about how, you know, you take sometimes two steps forward, one step back, because even when we had the chips to our credit cards,
yeah,
and people put those in, and then you have to wait, which seems like an eternity, but it's,
yeah,
4 seconds or whatever it is,
yeah,
and it feels like longer, and then consumers get so frustrated. So, I mean, you're right. All these technologies are an opportunity to improve the customer experience, but they're also an opportunity to rethink the customer experience in some way. And I think, do you ever feel that people are, like, what's an exciting usage of Sprinklr for you? Like, is it something where people are paying attention to what consumers are saying so that they can make their product better? Are there any particular stories you can tell, talk about that you're proud of?
Yeah, we have amazing, amazing stories. I just got to be careful that I'm not saying a story that I shouldn't be talking about in public, but I think McDonald's has gone public with the fact that they discovered the opportunity to create a new product, the all-day breakfast product, by listening to their customers on social media using Sprinklr. And then they validated it by looking at, you know, listening over time, and then launched that product using social and through Sprinklr. And that was, I think it was the single biggest product launch they've had in a long time, and it reversed the stock price. It was worth massive amounts of money to the brand.
It also switched the trajectory of my weight loss. So I have you to thank for all day McGriddles. So, but yeah, no,
you thank McDonald's. We they do stuff. We help. We're like Home Depot, right? You can do it. We can help.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, the fact that there's so much information out there to improve the product and the people who listen. I mean, just I can't help but think that we would have a Blockbuster on every corner if they were a Sprinklr client back in the day. You know.
Yeah, we have one of the largest PC manufacturer using Sprinklr to identify product problems from initial launch through sort of general availability, and they're able to about 15 to 30% of the product problems are now identified before they become big enough to hit the call center every month through automated volumetric and AI-based alerting that Sprinklr can do. We have many large brands that use Sprinklr for crisis detection and crisis management, which is a very powerful use case. Because in a world where customers are in control, look at what happened with United.
I was going to say, I mean, if you look at what's the value to you as a company to not have that tremendous market cap, you know, hit. It's huge.
If your podcast ever gets to anyone at United and the marketing team, this is, I would be so thrilled to have a conversation with anyone there. I have no idea why they're not using Sprinklr. No idea. But you know, we've just not been able to.
And you can quantify the value to it. Frankly,
we literally can, and we literally are able to show. You know, the value of personalized advertising. We 20% boost through just shutting off campaigns when they stop yielding results. Like when an agency runs it, human beings are constrained by how many things they can keep track of. Mm-hmm. So I do like 50 campaigns, I have those running, and then by the time I come back on the weekend to look at it, like 43 of them have stopped performing. And so just by using Sprinklr AI and automation, just by shutting off those campaigns that are not performing or reallocating against the best, you can get anywhere from 20 to 40% lift. You can look at data year over year. If I'm launching a car this year, you know, how did it do last year against all segments?
That's powerful.
The ability to A-B test, like millions of ways, really personalizing the message to the customer, that's another use case. So we are finally at a point where, you know, most of the big brands that we work with in, you know, the likes of Verizon and McDonald's and Nike and, you know, JP Morgan Chase and others, we are easily now able to quantify massive strategic impact. And, you know, while we like to think of as, yeah, that's Sprinklr enabling it, the truth is these brands are using customer experience and the voice of the customer to drive their business, and we're just proud to be enabling it.
Yeah, you get to kind of sit in between and really shine a light on these problems or opportunities.
Yes.
So I know I got to let you go in a minute or two. I had maybe two more super quick questions for you. One thing is actually, what's the best way, besides using Sprinklr, that's the easy one, but what's the best way an organization can best future-proof its marketing and communications? Is it attending conferences or hiring the right people or reading 100 articles a day? If there was a single prescriptive thing you would say in terms of future-proofing your marketing and communications, what would you put it at?
Embrace being customer first. Implement CXM. I'm not asking you to pick Sprinklr. Go pick whatever is best for you, but just you've got to think. Everything has been disrupted. Marketing and advertising has been disrupted massively. So you have to educate yourself. It's a big culture change. It's a process change. The world's largest company simply got there by being customer obsessed. And you know, the days of being product obsessed or brand obsessed, you know, I think, you know, I don't want to go extremes, but I'd say customer first is beating every other first right now, and that in every industry with the disruption that digital is bringing, more and more companies are coming with digital business models, and really enabling frictionless experiences and resetting customer expectations that will come back and bite everyone in the category and around the world. The reason you got really upset waiting for your credit card taking 4 seconds is because Google has taught you that every time you click something, it should just come back. Like, we were okay waiting 4 seconds. Like, we were okay waiting 10 seconds for a page to load Google did what they did. We were okay not knowing where things were on their way to coming to you until Uber showed up and made everyone think that I should know where my clothes are if I drop it off for laundry. Like, it's instrumentation. So these brands are resetting customer expectations. And that's not just affecting their category. That's affecting everyone and every brand.
That cues me up, I think, for my last question, which is, it sounds like, to kind of almost bubble this up, this whole conversation has been about reducing friction, right? Mm-hmm. The customer's expecting less and less friction as time goes on. So what are just general potential friction points you see out there that are going to be disrupted over the next few years or should be disrupted over the next few years?
Everything, my friend. It's terrible. It's embarrassing. Because every company, think about a large company with 7 business units, very possible, right? You're a Microsoft, you're a Dell, whoever. All these guys have all these even brands and business units. Every business unit is in somewhere between 30 and 150 countries for many of my clients. In every country, they have at least 5 customer-facing functions: marketing, advertising, research, commerce, care. In every function, they probably use somewhere between 3 and 30 channels to talk to the customer. In every channel, they have another point solution. So the context of that customer is getting buried in that little silo. Mm-hmm. And you multiply, right? So you think about the number of silos, thousands of silos, and large companies are unable to talk to a customer as that brand. Well, the customer sees that brand. Customer sees JP Morgan Chase. The trust gets eroded when someone lets them down on a channel in anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And they're not upset with Sally who sent that email. They're upset with JP Morgan Chase. They get upset with IBM or Microsoft or Sony or whatever. So I would say this is probably, it's going to take 10 years to for the system to kind of flush itself out. I think that's why I think the architecture is very, very powerful in trying to solve it. No one's going to replace all this, but we've got to stitch them together on an open architecture, which is what we've tried to do. So unfortunately, it's not a easy problem to have. We built this over the last, I'd say, 50 to 70 years, our customer-facing infrastructure. So I don't think it's a quick answer, but I think getting started and really picking the right partners is super important.
I love that. No, that's it's an important conversation to be had.
And I'm out there on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn or wherever. Hit any one of us up. You know, at Sprinklr, we're trying to practice what we preach. And I teach everyone that everyone is in product, everyone is in support, everyone is in sales, everyone is in customer success.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for making the time. Really appreciate it, Reggie. This was great.
Thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
And thanks again, Reggie, for making the time. And thank you all for listening. If this is your first episode, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next one. And feel free and you're encouraged, rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and wherever finer podcasts are sold. So, for now, this is Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.